from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in this morning's opening hour, in a unanimous decision, the California High Court has ruled that local governments have the power to ban medical marijuana dispensaries. The decision upholds bans in about 200 California cities, but in a state with a robust pot economy, lawmakers still debate if and how to regulate the drug. We'll discuss the ruling and what this means for the marijuana market, its dispensaries, and its consumers. Forum is next. Join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In a 7-0 decision, California's high court ruled that cities in the state can ban pot dispensaries via zoning ordinances. The case, Riverside versus Inland Empire Patients Health and Welfare Center, argues that state law does not preempt local governments from regulating use of its land. Presently, 200 governments in California have bans against local medical marijuana dispensaries, and in this opening forum hour, we want to focus on the state high court's decision and what it will mean for medical marijuana use and dispensaries in California. But first, we want to go to Yorba Linda and welcome Jeffrey Dunn. He's a partner in Best Bess and Krieger LLP. They represented the city of Riverside in this case, and this case, I should mention, came about from a marijuana collective in Riverside, which was challenged in terms of a local ban, and where a test of a dispensary ban had closed down 56 marijuana operators since 2009. Welcome, Jeffrey Dunn.
Thank you.
You are obviously pleased with this decision, and let's talk about the history of it just for a moment and what brought it to the Supreme Court.
Well, you know, City of Riverside found itself in a situation really not that different from many cities in Southern California. The city began to experience a proliferation of the medical marijuana dispensaries and began to ask itself, you know, what, if anything, it can do to sort of regulate or even restrict their operation in this area. And that started an examination into what other cities have done. And cities now have been using their land use authority to regulate and even restrict the operations.
What's the sense of, well, the people in Riverside? You know, I'm reading some of your local coverage of this, and it says local politicians wanted to close these dispensaries down, some of them, and wanted the land use, but didn't necessarily reflect the will of the people.
It's a controversial issue everywhere, and there are strong arguments on each side of the debate on the medicinal use of medical marijuana. Our sense is that with the city, as an entity, it doesn't want to enter into that debate, but rather has a public safety concern, and that is, it's the city's experience, and it's been observed in cities throughout Southern California and elsewhere, that these types of facilities typically attract what we generally call negative secondary impacts, but they include things such as, pretty serious crime, and often we see, abuse of the product that's being distributed. So it comes down primarily to a local public safety issue, and I don't think there's been a lot of debate within the city of Riverside about that issue.
So safety was the main issue from your perspective, but also what about wanting actually to have land use and to have a different sense of land use?
Well, that's a very important issue for cities and counties throughout the state. This is an issue, land use control, that transcends this controversial area of medical marijuana. And there was a concern here that various legal challenges coming before the courts, some brought by the cities and some brought by the marijuana operators, were focusing on that land use authority, and courts were going in different directions on that. So the fundamental exercise of that land use authority, to protect local safety, whether it's through zoning or just through other ordinances, is of vital importance to the cities and counties.
Now, I'm wondering how legally you challenge the fact that in 1996 there was a ballot measure which essentially legalized medical marijuana use, but also in the year 2004, the legislature authorized nonprofit collectives and ID cards to protect those operating these dispensaries from being arrested. So in a sense, are we preempting or not preempting state law here?
No, I think there's a different way to view it. And actually, I think the court in the unanimous decision has viewed it in the sense that what the voters did in 1996 is they did what they could do. And that is in the face of a federal prohibition on marijuana use, including use for medicinal purposes, the voters were free to express their desire and intent not to enforce state criminal sanctions against certain types of medicinal use. But again, in the face of the federal prohibition, which is applicable for all use in California, that's as far as the voters in the legislature are able to go.
Jeffrey Dunn, again with us from Yorba Linda, is a partner with Best Best and Krieger LLP, and that law firm represented the city of Riverside in this pretty landmark case. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Let me tell you who's joining us for the rest of the hour. We have Peter Heck with us from Sacramento, a reporter for the Sacramento Bee, and who has been diligently covering the story for a while here, an author of a forthcoming book called Weedland, due out in early 2014. Peter Heck, good to have you aboard.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Don Duncan with us, California Director of Americans for Safe Access, a medical marijuana advocacy group. Welcome, Don Duncan.
Good morning, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have McGregor Scott back with us on Forum, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of California during the George W. Bush administration, currently a partner in Orrick, Herrington and Sutcliffe Law Firm in Sacramento. Good morning, McGregor Scott.
Good morning to you, sir. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. And let me begin, Peter Hecht, if I may, with you. The response to this is ongoing in many controversial ways, but I guess from your perspective, it's not likely to have a great deal of effect.
Well, I think it might embolden some communities that don't want medical marijuana dispensaries in their midst, in particular where the local government is in line with the citizenry. But I think what you're going to see in a lot of communities is that the elected officials and their constituents are on different sides of the issue. You saw efforts in Santa Barbara, in Morro Bay, where you had ballot measures to ban dispensaries that were heartily defeated. Don may know more about this, but I would suspect that ultimately in Riverside you're going to see a referendum that will define what the rules are going to be and if the city will accept dispensaries or not.
But doesn't the ruling make it easier for cities to persuade the courts to sanction dispensaries with injustice, with the injunctions, excuse me, or with fines or, for that matter, with jail?
I don't know about jail, but absolutely in terms it's going to give them more authority to fend off legal challenges and control local land use. I think what you're going to see is in cities that want them, you're going to maybe see more reasonable numbers of dispensaries. But Los Angeles has given a clear illustration of how this is playing out, and that city passed a ban. And the Americans for Safe Access and other groups gathered signatures for a referendum. They stopped that action. Now we have three ballot measures coming up on the 21st of May that are basically going to decide how many dispensaries there are going to be in Los Angeles. So the people have taken it out of the hands of the politicians. And I wouldn't be surprised if this court decision inspires that in many areas of California where we're going to see a lot of these local elections to decide for sure what people and communities want.
Well, we now have 200 local governments that are sort of buttressed by this that have bans. But don't you think this will cause perhaps easier banning rather than allowing a limited number of dispensaries and regulating them, which has caused litigation all across the state?
Yeah, that's going to give them a lot of protection from that. But like I say, it depends what the local citizens want. I direct you to one of the state's most conservative counties, Butte County, which had a very restrictive ordinance on marijuana cultivation. It was thrown out by voters. They gathered signatures for a referendum, and they voted it out. So what you do see, and this is very reflective of our politics on a number of issues, where oftentimes people in the community have a more progressive view on what they're willing to tolerate than the elected officials. Some communities, and many of those 200 communities, I imagine, the citizenry and the elected officials may be on the same page in terms of the ban. But there are going to be friction points, and it's going to be interesting to watch this play out.
Well, speaking about elected officials, we've got a couple of bills from Daryl Steinberg and Tom Amiano, right?
Exactly. And I don't think the legislature is going to wade into the question that some of the marijuana advocates want them to do. I don't believe the legislature is going to say that communities can't ban dispensaries. So I don't expect them to try to rewrite this decision. But clearly the lack of state regulations has muddled the picture, has made it far more challenging for cities. There is nothing in Proposition 215, and there you have to really use almost a Ouija board to interpret the 2003 Senate Bill 420 to see what it allows and what it doesn't allow. Nowhere in any statute do you find the words medical marijuana stores or dispensaries, and that adds to the confusion. And in states like Colorado, they have very specific language permitting licensing medical marijuana centers that are actually authorized retail stores. We don't have that in California.
Well, not only Colorado, but Washington has something similar. There are regulations, and we have legalization here, but we don't have any system, frankly, for the Department of Health to issue licenses or permits or to control in any way. So we're without a regulatory system, right?
California, the market has grown so big, and the lawmakers did not react early. And now they're very, very intimidated by it. They're intimidated by getting disapproval of law enforcement. They're sort of afraid how to move forward on this. The medical marijuana movement wants regulation for protection, but they're not willing to sign off on a lot of the very strict things that have come down the pike in Colorado. And law enforcement, for whatever reason, doesn't see much incentive, as far as I can see, to deal on this issue.
Peter Heck with us from the State Capitol as a reporter for the Sacramento Bee, author of the forthcoming book, Weedland. And Don Duncan is California Director of Americans for Safe Access. They're a medical marijuana advocacy group. Must be pretty disappointed in this ruling, Don, huh?
Well, we are disappointed, although I can't say we're terribly surprised. It was pretty clear after the oral arguments what direction the justices were leaning. I think it's important that we remember with this decision that while the decision does uphold this sort of status quo where we have some places where access is allowed and some place where it's not, justices did not say that cities and counties have to ban medical marijuana facilities, and it does treat these organizations as legal. And the patients, collectives, and cooperatives that maintain these storefront facilities can be legal so long as they're obeying the guidelines established by the Attorney General back in 2008.
So your reading of this ruling is, your reading is that it allows discrepancies that are dispensaries that are legal. And there's no problem on that score at all. You're saying there's no problem on that score as far as the legality.
State legislature obviously needs to step in and be much more specific about access models in the state of California. But in 2004, the Medical Marijuana Program Act did recognize the right of patients to act collectively and cooperatively to cultivate their medicine. And in 2008, the Attorney General clarified that could, in fact, mean maintaining a storefront to provide it. Now, I would agree, of course, that it's past time for the state legislature to be much, much more specific about how these organizations are organized and operated. But we also have to remember that while there are some public safety concerns, it's regulation that deal with those concerns, not bans outright. Bans just push things sort of back into the shadows and back into the illicit market, which is where folks in Riverside will be stuck for the time being. But our research and our experience since 1996 show us that sensible regulations preserve that legal access for the patients who need it, but they also reduce crime and reduce complaints. And so
yeah,
that's
really
the path that the legislature should follow.
You did some research to show fewer crimes, fewer complaints, and less neighborhood complaints with regulation. So it seems to be to highlight this, the necessity for regulation is being called for from both sides. And once again, not necessarily getting the action out of the legislature. But this ruling doesn't answer, how big the dispensaries can be or if you know, where it's going to be growing, that is the cannabis, or what makes a dispensary a nonprofit? There's still big questions.
There are. Now, the legislative proposals in Sacramento this year do start to wade into that territory. And so we're very eager for these bills to be developed and to get those details answered. We certainly need to bring the cultivation of medical cannabis into the sunlight and have a transparent and accountable system. And in order to do that, we're going to need cooperation from law enforcement. Right now, patients who cultivate medical cannabis for themselves or collectively and cooperatively are justifiably afraid of enforcement. And that's both local, state, and federal enforcement.
So you're kind of summoning legislators here as well as voters to adopt regulations, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. One of our primary focuses in California this year is to promote principles of sensible medical cannabis regulation and to help shape these bills so that they do what the voters intended when they approved Proposition 215. Recall that while Proposition 215 didn't legalize an access model, the voters did call very explicitly on lawmakers to come up with a plan for access for everyone who needs safe access to medical cannabis. And so the legislative process this year is a part of that ongoing process from Proposition 215.
It's pretty muddled, though, in terms of federal guidelines of authority versus state guidelines versus local guidelines. But at least as I read this, the court is saying state laws are meant to protect users from arrest, but not necessarily limit local government from exercising its authority.
That's probably a fair analysis. We have to remember that while federal law remains in effect, it absolutely does not trump our state law. The state laws about medical cannabis are still in effect, and our state courts, our state lawmakers, our state law enforcement officials have a constitutional obligation to obey that state law. And so we don't really need to wring our hands about the federal law. We just need to keep working to change it. And in the meantime, we need sensible regulations both at the local level and at the state level so that we don't deal with some of the nuisance activity that's been associated with medical cannabis. Although I should point out that the vast majority of the patients' associations in the state of California are not a problem for their neighborhood. It's only a small number of facilities that get a lot of attention that are a problem. Most of these facilities do their compassionate work and don't impact their neighborhoods.
Again, Don Duncan with us from Sacramento is California Director of Americans for Safe Access, a medical marijuana advocacy group. And we should mention, by the way, that one of California's oldest medical marijuana dispensaries, Berkeley Patients Group, was served with a lawsuit on Friday in an attempt to seize the property in which it operates and ultimately shut the facility down. It's a forfeiture complaint, and it's similar to the one that was filed against Oakland's Harborside Health Center last July. This is from the U.S. Attorney's Office. They make no mention of local or state law violations. I want to bring McGregor Scott into this. He's a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of California and served during the George W. Bush administration. Currently, he's a partner at Orrick, Herrington, and Sutcliffe Law Firm in Sacramento. I guess, McGregor Scott, this is a pretty straightforward legal opinion on preemption.
I think it is. There's nothing really out of the ordinary. There's nothing mysterious about the opinion. It really is a very simple question of whether or not the state law on medical marijuana preempted the city of Riverside's ordinance banning dispensaries. And the court held very clearly, without any dissent, a 7-0 unanimous opinion, that the medical marijuana law is a narrowly drawn, limited law which only applies to a certain number of persons and situations in the state. And the longstanding legal doctrine around that is that in that limited setting, preemption does not apply. And that as a result, the city, as cities and counties have historically in California, has the right and the discretion to enact zoning ordinances as they see fit.
Gives them the wide discretion under it, what you're describing as longstanding state law. Yeah,
that's absolutely correct. And the preemption doctrine only really applies when the state law is a broad, general, encompassing everyone and everything law, and that's just simply not what we have, as the court pointed out in great detail in the opinion with respect to medical marijuana.
So, and this is a unanimous decision, and it was actually upholding an appellate decision, holding that state medical marijuana law is not a general or all-encompassing law.
Correct, because there is, you have to start from the premise that marijuana remains illegal under California law. And then what the medical marijuana law does is carve out in limited circumstances an exception to that general ban. So that is the way the court looked at it, and thus the court's ruling that it was a limited law, not a general broad law, which prohibited the use of the preemption doctrine in its analysis.
Well, let's hear from you, our listeners, on this subject. We'd like to hear from you. You can call us now at 866-733-6786 and weigh in. Again, our toll-free number is available to you for your comments or questions, and we'd like to hear from you. It's 866-733-6786. You can also join the conversation on our website or our Facebook page, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Again, in a unanimous decision, the state high court has ruled that local governments have the power to ban medical marijuana dispensaries, and the decision upholds the bans in about 200 California cities. But in a state with a robust pot economy, lawmakers are still going to have to debate if and how to regulate the drug. And we're discussing the ruling, what this means for the marijuana market, its dispensaries, and its consumers. And the fact of the matter is that there are 18 states that have decriminalized marijuana, but all have done it differently. And the cry here, sort of underlying a lot of this discussion, is the need for regulation. Again, you may want to put your own sense in. I also want to add one other thing that probably needs to be pointed out here, and maybe it's obvious, but we need some scientific measure of when marijuana is a problem, and some of you may indeed want to address that as well. We have Peter Heck with us, reporter for the Sacramento Bee and author of the forthcoming book Weedland, which will be out in early 2014. Don Duncan, the California director of Americans for Safe Access, which is a medical marijuana advocacy group, and McGregor Scott, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of California. We also spoke earlier with Jeffrey Dunn, a partner in Best & Best & Krieger, which represented the city of Riverside in this case. And Riverside is, McGregor Scott, let me get a reading from you on this. I asked Jeffrey Dunn about the fact that the will of the people may be very different than the politicians. And that's another divide here that when you're talking about local decision-making, has to be taken into account. How do you see that?
Well, the reality is that the five members of the County Board of Supervisors are elected officials. And as a result, they have to factor into their decision-making the political climate around a particular issue, and that's equally true of this concept of a ban on dispensaries of medical marijuana. So it is, as Peter pointed out, I mean, there may be ballot efforts made by the proponents to overturn some of these bans, but I think you used the number 200 cities and counties across the state who had enacted these bans. That's not a small number. And I think many of those bans very well may reflect a political support within particular cities or counties that we don't want this. And we don't necessarily have any opposition to individuals who may have recommendations from growing a limited number of plants in some manner, but the concept of a storefront operation openly selling marijuana, oftentimes at profit, is not something that we want to have in our community. And there very well may be political will in many cities and counties across this state in support of such a ban.
But when you are talking about the federal trumping the state, which is now the case, doesn't this allow local jurisdiction room to disagree and therefore go against perhaps what might be the state legislation?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite follow that question.
Well, I'll come back to it, actually, and I'll come to our listeners because we're coming up on a break. I'm just talking about the hierarchy of authority from fed to state to local, and we'll hear you and perhaps the others on the panel opine on that, but I certainly want to hear from listeners as well. Again, it's toll-free 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're discussing the California Supreme Court's decision ruling that cities can ban pot dispensaries. We spoke earlier with Jeffrey Dunn, a partner in the firm that represented the city of Riverside in this case. And with us for the hour, Peter Hecht, a reporter from the Sacramento Bee, Don Duncan, California Director of Americans for Safe Access, and McGregor Scott, former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of California. You are welcome to join the program toll-free 866-733-6786 or by email forum@kqed.org or on our website, kqed.org/forum. Simply click on the segment, or, of course, you can go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. We're going to go to your calls and emails in just a moment here. I wanted, though, to get to the sort of central question here with respect to medical marijuana and hear from both McGregor Scott and Don Duncan on this. The idea that the Fed can trump the state, McGregor Scott. I mean, this has been proven in the last couple of administrations. And yet the state seems to be, in this sense, almost trumped by the local. It allows local jurisdiction room to disagree with the state. So I'm just wondering about the lines of we have no regulatory system in California, but the lines of regulatory authority seem pretty inconsistent and murky.
Well, it's I think it's simpler than your question poses it to be, and you have to start with respect to the federal to state relationship. You have to start with the idea that marijuana, period, is banned for all purposes under federal law. There is no exception. So the preemption doctrine, arguably, although it's not been really litigated in a court yet, applies in that situation because it fits the legal analysis that I discussed in the first half an hour, where if it is a broad general law that applies to all circumstances, preemption applies. Now, relative to the state to city or county relationship, for the reasons we discussed earlier, that broad, all-encompassing analysis does not apply because the medical marijuana situation is a limited, narrow set of circumstances. So your question is correct, but when you look at the legal analysis that applies to the preemption doctrine, it's not a very complicated analysis.
And Don Duncan, let's get you on record here on this.
Well, federal law, of course, makes all cannabis-related activity illegal, but the fact that federal law and state law differ does not invalidate our state laws. While federal law still applies, our state laws, of course, are still valid as well. And this is just a function of our federalist system. And so you'll often hear people say federal law trumps our state law, and that's an inaccurate description. In fact, our state laws still stand, and believe me, if there were any way the federal government could have overturned Proposition 215, I am certain they would have done it by now, but it does stand as good law in the state of California. Now, when it comes to the local versus the state issue, the Supreme Court has spoken, and that's the landscape we live in now, is that while the collective and cooperative associations and their storefronts are not illegal under the state law, they can be banned under the local law. And so that's the political reality that we're operating in now. And what that means is that the court's sort of passing the ball back to the state legislature now, and then back to the people in local jurisdictions. And so the next step for us, of course, is to get the best regulations we can get in the political morass of Sacramento, and then to work with local communities where there are obstacles to safe access, to adopt new city ordinances, new county ordinances, or where it's necessary, even go to the ballot with voter initiatives and try to make some progress for patients. Because ultimately, what we want to see is safe and legal and, above all, dignified access to medical cannabis for everyone in California who needs it. That's what the voters wanted when they approved Proposition 215, and that's really what's in the best interest of our communities.
Can we hear from you on this, Peter Hecht?
Well, the interesting thing about the marijuana landscape in California is you have a billion-dollar-plus industry that hangs on the threads of very vague language, legislative language, that says medical marijuana patients can collectively or cooperatively cultivate marijuana. And very few people seem to agree on what that means. Police and many agencies say, no, that doesn't mean that you could operate a medical marijuana store. Others in other jurisdictions say, yes, in fact, you can run these stores, which operate as collectives and so forth. I think that was a mistake at the time in trying to make people feel comfortable. I think what the legislature needs to deal with is, number one, first decide, do they want dispensaries to be legal? And if so, say so explicitly. And if they want to set limits, say so explicitly. But we've had this vagueness of language that has added tremendously to the challenges, and that has rippled up from statewide all the way down to local communities.
Well, let me bring our listeners into this and go right to your calls. We'll begin with George. Good morning. You're on the air, George.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a physician. I'm a psychiatrist in San Francisco. And one of the issues that I think is not being addressed is the way that marijuana has been medicalized. And in my experience, both as a physician and personally, most people going to dispensaries are actually obtaining it for recreational use or quasi-recreational use, which I'm not opposed to. But what happens then, it gives it sort of a quasi-legitimacy that's not been vetted out. So, for example, I had patients come to me and ask for medical marijuana for anxiety or depression, for which there's no indication. And there's a lot of side effects to marijuana which are not being considered in this whole debate. So I think that the medicalization of it has been a cop-out in terms of the legislature and the government in really legalizing a drug that can be used recreationally with the appropriate control. And that's my comment.
Yeah, well, I thank you for the comment. Peter Heck, let me go to you on this. There's been a lot of concern, of course, that many people are going to these dispensaries and getting marijuana dispensed to them without having a medical problem, or at least getting a prescription that allows them without necessarily medical reasoning behind it.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why this is a very provocative issue in California. I think also it's another reason why there is a sense of backlash in law enforcement and some constituencies. The bottom line is Prop 215 says you can obtain a physician's recommendation for medical marijuana for a list of very serious symptoms, as well as any other condition for which marijuana may provide relief. So that has opened the door fairly widely to a cottage industry of medical marijuana physicians, some very principled, others maybe not so much, that make fairly lucrative livings giving out these recommendations, even as the price of these things just flatlines. And interesting enough, the California Medical Association finally just threw up its hands and said, well, let's just legalize it. And the reason why is they wanted to take physicians out of the role of gatekeepers. So essentially, the physicians became the gatekeepers for people wanting to consume marijuana illegally, and it put some of them into an awkward position. I'm not sure what the lawmakers can do about this, because I don't think voters are going to accept a rewrite of Proposition 215. But clearly that has stoked the debate, that not everybody out there is seriously ill. On the other hand, there have been landmark California medical marijuana clinical studies that have shown that pot actually does have far broader clinical applications than originally thought. So it's a pretty interesting discussion.
Well, it is. And Don Duncan, you talked about the integrity of dispensaries and, you know, the fact that they do serve the public in many ways, and I'm certain that's true. But we heard from Jeffrey Dunn earlier on about at least a case in Riverside where he said they were a nuisance, and I'm sure you've heard that before, that you get a bad element at some of these dispensaries and that they create problems within the local jurisdiction.
We do hear that a lot. It's a commonly repeated phrase that dispensaries lead to crime. There's no research at all that supports that. And we have to remember that while there are almost certainly, in fact, there certainly are a handful of these facilities that are located in an inappropriate place or operated in a way that's problematic, it's not fair to paint all of the collectives and cooperatives with the same brush. Nor is it fair to say that if some people are obtaining medical cannabis under false pretenses, that would justify restricting or cutting off access for all of the legal patients in the state of California. So the way to deal with abuse, whether that be at the storefront level, at the patient level, or even at the doctor level, is to better regulate the system. We've really passed the point in California, I think, where we're talking about repealing Proposition 215. Medical cannabis is here to stay in our state. What we need to do right now is figure out how to do it well. And I certainly think there's a better role for the California Medical Board to play in regulating the recommendations of medical cannabis. And they may not want to have that role, but it certainly does fall to them. The legislature may also need to step into that area of regulation as well. Right now, though, what's on the table are regulations for the cultivation, the distribution, and the provision of medical cannabis. And we really need those on the books this year so that we can start reaping the rewards that we know come with regulation. Remember, research that we've conducted and the experience here in California, as well as the 17 other states where medical cannabis is legal, show that regulations work. And so we need to move down that path, regardless of whether or not somebody might be bending the rules or some of our communities are still feeling a little bit squeamish about medical cannabis. We can make things better.
Well, McGregor Scott, would you agree with the wisdom of that, that abuse, whether it's in the storefront or physicians or whatever, means better regulations or the necessity of better regulations?
I don't necessarily think that's right. You know, I would cite specifically to a case that my office prosecuted when I was the United States Attorney out of Modesto, which was a storefront operation grossing millions of dollars annually in profits, openly selling marijuana, basically to anybody who walked in the door under the guise of medical marijuana. And their big defense was, oh, we're in compliance with state law. So, there, you know, I appreciate the point is being made, and there are certainly a large number of persons who want to use medical marijuana for legitimate purposes, but we should not turn a blind eye to the fact that Prop 215 has massively enabled a corrupt element which has sought, number one, to profit by the open selling of marijuana by hiding behind 215. And as the doctor mentioned on the call-in just a few moments ago, you know, lots of newspaper studies and investigations have been done about how ridiculously simple and easy it is to acquire a, quote, medical marijuana recommendation in this state because, frankly, because of the point that Peter made, it's the statute allows for any other illness for which marijuana provides relief. Well, what the heck does that mean? And there is abuse. There has been abuse from day one. And we can't just, you know, turn a blind eye to that. And it is a massive problem, the corruption taking place around this, the hiding behind 215 to simply make a whole lot of money selling dope. And that's what's happened all too often in this state.
I hear some different opinions from listeners that I wanted to read and get on the record here. Jessica writes, how do we know that closing legal dispensaries is necessarily going to lead to a decrease in crime? I'm responding to a comment by your first guest that medical marijuana dispensaries in cities like Riverside lead to a rise in crime. Won't closing the dispensaries lead to an increase in the marijuana sold on the black market, particularly from cartels? And aren't legal, taxable marijuana dispensaries in our local cities a good way to combat the huge amounts of illegal marijuana in California? Another listener, Barbie, writes on Facebook, there's a dispensary in our neighborhood. It's clean, attracts no more crime than the local Starbucks located in the same mini strip mall. According to studies being conducted at UCLA, I read that banks tend to attract more crime, but residents are neither concerned about that nor the pervasiveness of massage parlors around our area. And Ari says they should regulate as needed. But why are cities banning pot dispensaries? Why can't politicians and legislators acknowledge that keeping a plant illegal is antithetical to freedom? Here's Mark from Sacramento. Mark, join us.
Yes, I'm a cancer patient, and I've had throat cancer and radiation, and, you know, like 85% of America is for medical marijuana. And my question is twofold. One is, what is the best approach since the majority of California and probably the majority of America, you know, wants medical marijuana? Is it the legislation approach, or should we go for initiative in Sacramento? And my second part of my question is, why is it that the police are almost against everything about marijuana? Is it because they're afraid of their jobs? SB 289 was a prime example of that.
Well, to the first question, Peter Hecht, we had an initiative 215, as has been mentioned many times here in the course of this hour, and other legislation has not necessarily moved forward to the satisfaction of callers like Mark, I would say.
No, not at all. And it is very puzzling, and it's an interesting phenomenon that California was the first in the nation in all of this, and then all of a sudden it lags behind other states in sort of taking charge of this and setting the rules. I think the law enforcement question the gentleman raised is very interesting. And when you look at police and support or opposition to marijuana issues, the only ones in support have a key characteristic. They all have the word retired or former in front of their name. People in law enforcement are loath to work with this issue. And to a certain extent, I wonder why, because I think some clearer rules and negotiations would make the job easier for state and local law enforcement. But I do sense the medical marijuana movement and law enforcement interests are just operating in different orbits. And they work together a little bit in drafting Senate Bill 420, but since then they've been very distant, and I think that would help the process if they could, there could be some meeting of the minds there.
Peter Hechtigan is reporter with the Sacramento Bee, author of the forthcoming book, Weedland, and let me bring another of your calls on. Robert joins us. Good morning, Robert. Robert, are you there? Well, no, not there. I'm going to go to another caller in a moment, but he wanted to ask about liquor stores. It's an interesting point. I'd like to hear you opine on, McGregor Scott, that you could make the same argument about increased crime about liquor stores that you could about marijuana dispensaries, if indeed there is increased crime.
Well, I suppose you could. I did want to point out that the statement was made earlier that there are no studies that validate the concept that medical marijuana dispensaries draw more crime. And I can cite to at least one study that was undertaken by the Riverside County District Attorney, and which I believe was used as support for the ban that was ultimately enacted by the city, which demonstrated quite clearly that there was, in fact, enhanced criminal activity around these facilities. So I'm not saying it's a perfect study. I'm not saying it's the answer to the situation, but there has been at least that one study done which corroborates that connection.
Can I ask Don Duncan, do you know about that study? Just and then we'll go back to the liquor store question.
I'm sorry to say I don't know the specific study in Riverside, although what we see very often in this debate are anecdotes where law enforcement may pick a particularly egregious offender to hold up as an example. And the same thing happens on the other side to a certain extent as well. But I can tell you at the very height of medical marijuana facilities in Los Angeles, which has been greater than any other place really in the world. And at the height of that proliferation, even the chief of police was conceding to the city council that, in fact, they weren't seeing a correlation between medical marijuana and crime per se, even though there are anecdotes where that may be the case. And that's why we have to have some standard rules and some regulations to deal with those exceptions that are a problem for our community. But we have to resist this temptation to hold up an anecdote and say everyone is a problem because this one facility or this one person or this one doctor is misbehaving.
Go back to you, McGregor Scott.
Well, I think the study that I referenced earlier, the issue was not necessarily a single cannabis club or dispenser. It was dispensary. It was the issues that arose around its existence. So you had what we used to refer to when I was DA as quality of life crimes, and not so the connection is an uptick or upswing in those quality of life crimes around the physical location, not necessarily the dispensary's operation itself. So I wanted to make that point.
Well, let me read another message from a listener on our website who writes, this is Sam. Thank you for the message, Sam. He writes, it makes sense that banning pot dispensaries is within the legal right of a community, but why is it a good idea? People who have a pharmaceutical need to buy marijuana have good cause to want easy access, and everyday marijuana smokers have as much of a right to enjoy their favorite substance in peace as much as alcohol drinkers, tea drinkers, coffee drinkers, and tobacco smokers. It's peculiar that folks are fine with people getting drunk at bars in their town but not smoking marijuana. Perhaps in part this is a deeply rooted fear in our society. Mark from Berkeley says, I'm usually on the far left side of the spectrum, but I can see the wisdom in curtailing dispensaries in California. Let's face reality. Most people with medical marijuana cards are recreational users. California's ridiculous medical marijuana system has resulted in an industry of unscrupulous doctors sitting at desks writing prescriptions as fast as their little fingers can go, and storefront dispensaries selling treats to stoners of all ages. Either we should tighten up the process of getting the drug to people who really need it or just legalize it for everyone. And Molly writes, wouldn't legalizing marijuana make it safer? I agree it should be regulated, which would lead to more money for the state and city. So why is it bad? People are still going to use it. We might as well make it safe and reduce the legal and prison costs associated with it. Another listener writes, I hate the smell of pot, but who cares? It's a trifling issue compared to the $1 trillion plus, that's trillion, T not B, trillion, that the United States spends on its racist drug war with disastrous effects on our own and other countries. So bring noxious pot fumes. Joseph from San Francisco says, I think it's more likely than not that marijuana will be legalized statewide within the next few years, a la Colorado and Washington. And, well, how would this affect yesterday's ruling? Want to opine on that, Peter Heck?
Well, I do think California is going to have a legalization measure in 2016. I think it likely will pass. But I don't think it's going to mean a lot other than some liberty for individual marijuana smokers as long as the state still fails to pass meaningful regulations. And so the lack of rules, the lack of guidelines certainly keeps journalists in business, but it has created a lot of confusion. And that's why you have these a lot of concern in a lot of communities.
You want to talk, Peter, just specifically for a few seconds about the Steinberg and Amiano bills and what would change if they do get through?
Well, the Amiano bill, it goes the farthest, and it's almost in its third iteration, and it would broadly license commercial operators involved in everything from growing to transportation to distribution. For some reason, state legislation, they don't want to, they never want to say dispensaries or marijuana stores. I don't fully understand that. But that of all the legislation would most broadly sanction a medical marijuana industry. The Steinberg bill, which he has indicated to me he expects will be heavily rewritten before it is done, essentially seeks to codify a guidelines published by then Attorney General Jerry Brown in 2008, which sort of broadly interpreted the notion of collectives and cooperatives and saying that they could distribute marijuana in nonprofit ventures, while not expressly saying that marijuana stores are legal and, in fact, even expressing some doubt. So I'm not sure that would work because it would sort of codify the existing.
Well, as you said, Daryl Steinberg is going to be rewriting it anyway, and I just want to take this moment to remind listeners that you are listening to Forum, and also that this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let's go to another caller, and that's Callie from Sacramento. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to point out, and thank you, by the way, for Don Duncan for being there for us, Sacramento had originally 120 dispensaries in the Sacramento County alone, and in the actual guidelines of the body where it says, you know, what would happen if this, you know, wasn't something, a bill that we did, that we could allow dispensing in Sacramento County because they were going in that direction, instead they had 120 dispensaries closed down, and in fact there was even one dispensary that was raided by the sheriff's department. The people had a tank in their front yard for only enough cannabis for two patients. On the news, it was reported that they had 80 pounds. I mean, what is that about? Do the federal government, do they feed money into the sheriff's department in Sacramento County Jail? Is that what we're up against? Is that why patients can't get their medicine?
Want to respond to her, McGregor Scott?
Well, I don't know the particulars of the one specific case that she mentioned, but and I'm not sure exactly what the question was, but the concept is that we don't necessarily always know the facts behind a case just because of what we hear from someone who may have some connection to it. So if it was publicly reported that there were 80 pounds of marijuana in connection to these two plants, I suspect that that's probably what occurred.
And Don Duncan, you know about the case?
I don't know which specific case the caller is referring to, although the tendency to exaggerate and spin, of course, goes both ways in this issue. I never take at face value the press releases I see from law enforcement, and not necessarily even a media report until the facts come out. Unfortunately, they rarely do in these sorts of cases.
Let me thank Kelly for her call. I want to get another caller on here, and that's you, Ryan. Hi, you're on.
Hey, Michael. I was just hoping that your guest could expand on the whole alcohol versus marijuana. How many people are hurt, injured, or killed by drunk drivers every year versus people who are high on marijuana? And if we even track that, and why have one without the other? It seems like if marijuana is so awful, we should get rid of alcohol as well.
Well, as I said earlier, and maybe Peter Hecht, you can weigh in on this, we need a lot more scientific measurement of the effect of marijuana. And the fact of the matter is a lot more people do die from alcohol.
Well, and alcohol is still a lot more pervasive. They're actually trying, and I think Don could offer some insights in this as well. Washington has, as part of its legalization measure, the nation's first sort of blood alcohol level for cannabis, and it's measured in by nanograms of THC, the psychoactive element in the blood. Now, not all the marijuana community is happy with this because there's huge debate over what constitutes impairment, and some people may have residues in their system for quite some time and they're not at all impaired. And so there's a lot of debate about that. And there was huge controversy in California just recently when law enforcement pushed a bill that would have required a zero tolerance threshold. In other words, any level you could be convicted of driving impaired on any level, and that did not get out of committee. So there's emerging science on that. It's an interesting debate. My suspicion is ultimately you are going to see some sort of follow to the Washington model, and you'll see a driving standard for marijuana.
Well, I want to extend thanks to all who joined us. Peter Hecht, again, is a reporter of the Sacramento Bee. We look forward to his forthcoming book, Weedland, which will appear early 2014. Thank you for joining us this hour, Peter Hecht.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Don Duncan, California Director of Americans for Safe Access, a medical marijuana advocacy group. Good to have had you, Don. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And my thanks to McGregor Scott, former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of California during the George W. Bush administration, currently a partner with Ora Carrington and Sutcliffe Law Firm in Sacramento. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it very much.
I also appreciate Jeffrey Dunn being with us earlier, partner with Best, Best & Krieger LLP. He joined us from Yorba Linda. That's the law firm that represented the city of Riverside in this case. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. Another hour of forum up ahead. Decided shift of gears. We're going to talk about Iranian-American literature. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.